Taking Stock
with Mandy Johnston.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston and this is the show that takes a deeper look at the stories that are making the news here in Ireland and around the world. Coming up on today's show, we'll be exploring everything from Davos to Disney. As global leaders gathered in the Swiss Alps this week, we're going to look at the origins of the conference and find out exactly what's been happening over there. And over at Disney, the executive chairs were spinning like a merry-go-round. I'll be chatting to the FT's LA chief about all the drama in the boardroom at one of the largest media companies in the world. And finally, we'll ask why so many Chinese investors are suddenly flocking to the Emerald Isle. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. But first up today, for 1 week every January, a small Swiss village becomes the epicentre of geopolitical intrigue, economic debate and Olympic-style shoulder rubbing. Davos has become the home of an event that attracts business leaders, politicians, the odd celebrity and many, many esteemed journalists. And I'm delighted to be joined by one of them now. British journalist and co-host of the News Agents podcast, John Sopel. You're very welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock.
Mandy, thank you so much for inviting me.
Not at all. Now, I cannot imagine for a second that this is your first spin on this particular merry-go-round. Can you just give us a flavour of what it is like to be a journalist travelling to Davos?
Okay, so the first time I think I came, I was presenting a Sunday political show on BBC One in the UK, and I'd come out to interview Tony Blair, who was then the Prime Minister. And his people said to me, look, if you want to have a chat with the Prime Minister before your interview, he's going to be at this particular reception at this particular time in this particular hotel. So I went there, small room. I mean, no bigger than someone's living room, really. I walk in and there's Tony Blair and there's Desmond Tutu and there's Prince Andrew and there is Bono. And there is Claudia Schiffer, and there is the president of Mozambique, and there is Bill Gates and Melinda Gates. I was the only person in the room that I hadn't heard of. And I thought, this is Madame Tussauds that's come to life. And it was, and that's the sort of weirdness. And it was, and last night I was a reception, you know, in this kind of log cabin. I mean, a glorified log, big log cabin out in the middle of nowhere, where, again, Tony Blair was funnily enough there. The Labour Party leader was there. A couple of government ministers were there. A princess was there. There were two US senators there. And, you know, all these, and you just think, your head keeps turning. You think, oh my God, look over there. Oh, over there as well. And it's just everywhere you go, you think it's sort of like a fantasy dinner party game. Where I can't believe all these people are here. And kind of part of me is cynical about it. And part of me thinks, well, you know what? It's kind of pretty impressive that an awful lot of people are able to get an awful lot of business done by coming to this weird event.
Mm. Yeah, and we'll come back to that in a moment about how much is actually achieved. And if there was an award for name dropping, John, I would be giving you the gold medal for that. Well done. And of course, here in Ireland, we don't think there's any summit that can happen internationally that has any kind of credence if Bono's not there. So, yeah. That's a must for us. John, like, you know, there's a growing sense that globalization is diminishing and there's a sense, you know, looking at this from afar at least, that there's a little bit of loss really in the cachet of this event. Does it still have the gravitas? Does it still get the business done that it did years ago? I know it's over 50 years old now, but do you think it's still a place where people can credibly get business done?
I think people get credit, business gets done, but not in maybe the way that you think. I mean, I don't think it's because of debates on the floor or some of these kind of lofty, windy themes that they talk about. And it's sort of like listening to a word salad of some of the kind of things that are under discussion. And they're also, you know, they're also discussing sustainability. And 1 in 10 of the people that are here have arrived on private jets.
Yeah, it's hardly the greenest gathering in the world, I'd imagine.
Exactly. You think you're having a laugh. But the fact that, you know, bank governors are able to meet on the sidelines or politicians are able to meet. And, you know, I saw the T-shirt you know, Leo Varadkar there today. He was walking through the halls. You know, they must think it's worth their while to come, because I mean, I think that it's sort of like Love Island meets Dreary Politics, where there is this sort of speed dating going on, and that there, and you kind of have 15 minute slots. You arrange to meet this one and that one. You're at breakfast from 6 a.m. You're then at kind of, you know, having a nightcap somewhere organized until, you know, 1 in the morning, and you're getting to meet an awful lot of people. So, you know, if you're the Labour Party leader in the UK, Keir Starmer, you know, you've never been before, and he kind of clearly thought it was worth his while, because it establishes him a bit on the world stage. He meets an awful lot of people who, if he becomes prime minister, he'll have to do business with. And so, you know, the calculation is made. It is worth my while coming out. And so whilst I think you're right to say that the high water of kind of internationalism, globalization has probably passed, particularly because of the pandemic, because of food security, because of Ukraine, and people are thinking, geez, we need to have our own, you know, we need to make sure that we can feed our own people and have, and also in a medical emergency, we need to be able to supply our own PPE, which we weren't able to do when the pandemic struck. So yeah, maybe the peak of globalization has passed, but there's still an awful lot of things to do. And I think that makes it, I think the calculation for a lot of politicians, for bankers and the rest, is it's still worth coming.
Yeah, let's look at some of the issues that they looked at this week. And I know you've been talking to Keir Starmer, and you're absolutely right. Keir Starmer made headlines in Ireland this morning from 6 a.m. He was part of the news bulletin. And I don't think if he was making a speech, with no disrespect, in Nottingham University, it would have hit the headlines in the way that it did when he was at Davos. What was his message over there? What was he talking to you about?
Well, I think he... funnily enough, we also spoke to the former British Foreign Secretary William Hague, Conservative, who was, you know, leader of the Conservative Party, and I kind of thought it was kind of interesting that they were both saying very similar things, that there is very deep alarm about Britain's place in the world post Brexit. Keir Starmer was more cagey about that, but it's clear that an awful lot of people think that the United Kingdom has become a basket case, that investment is low, that it's got the slowest growth rate in the G7, that it's only one of the G7 countries that whose economy has not grown back to pre-pandemic levels. And, you know, and what is it that's unique about Britain compared to a lot of these other countries? Brexit. And so, you know, I think that there is a feeling that they just want to bang the drum for Britain and try to convince people, industrialists, billionaires, that it is still a good place to come and set up their factory or whatever it happens to be, to manufacture, to do services, and that Britain is still a big player. And I think that for the British, it's even more urgent probably to be at Davos than it is for, say, some other countries which are, you know, still, relatively speaking, coming out of the post-pandemic cycle that we've been in.
And beyond the international headlines that they can get from it, I suppose those soft meetings around the margins of the debates, as you said, can be very effective. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, and I'm talking to John Sopel of the New Agents podcast. Back to Davos now. So who else has been there? Who else have you been talking to? Is there anybody who struck you as making a big impact at this year's meeting?
I think the biggest impact has been made by, I mean, you know, so kind of on in head straight headline terms, Olaf Scholz, you know, the German Chancellor was there. I met it was almost casually informal, that you're at a reception, you've got a drink in your hand, you're in a heated room. And I met last night, and this moved me enormously, was the head of Ukrainian energy. And okay. I thought, oh, my God, you are the guy that is trying to keep the lights on and the heating going in the depths of a bitterly cold winter, while Russian forces are attacking with drones, attacking with missiles, critical infrastructure. And you kind of think that actually you can be up this mountain and think all is well with the world, everything is wealthy, and yeah, we're talking about poverty and hunger and all those things, but people have got full bellies and they've got plenty to drink. And just
meeting somebody like that for whom the challenges are just awesome and existential, I think is kind of humbling. And so the fact that you're not shutting out the world, and are cognizant of some of the nightmares that people are going through, I think is important.
And of course, he would have been dealing with that tragic accident where they lost their own interior minister. And yeah, as you say, the scale of what an enormity of what they're dealing with, very difficult for us on a human level to even comprehend that. Did Ukraine as an issue for global leaders feature heavily in this summit, or was it just something on the margins of Europe? Did you get a sense that, you know, beyond what we're dealing with, it was a wider concern?
Look, I think it is the most shocking event in probably most of our lifetimes, the idea that, you know, in Europe, the invasion has taken place of another country, and the invasion has been led in contravention of all international law by a permanent member of the Security Council, Russia. So I think that there is a profound sense of shock about all of that. But you've still kind of got all the other debates going on about green energy and, you know, the other things that Davos is best known for. I'm not sure how agile it is when it comes to adjusting to the kind of war footing that much of Europe feels that it's on. And if you're in a country that is bordering Russia or bordering Ukraine, you are feeling quite vulnerable now. And I'm not sure how good Davos is at doing that, when it much prefers to kind of, you know, be talking about the bigger themes of global cooperation and the like, you know, which kind of people love to talk about. But I think Ukraine undoubtedly has been the backdrop to so much.
Just coming back closer to home now, and you mentioned Brexit earlier. There's a new national pastime in Ireland, and it's called Brexit and the Brexit Protocol. We just love talking about it. It's endless. Has that surfaced on the margins of any of the things you've been covering?
Well, I caught up with the Taoiseach today and asked Leo Varadkar, you know, what he thought. I mean, it wasn't an interview. He was rushing down a corridor. We were chasing after him, trying to get, you know, catch a word. If things were done by sentiment, then I think we're in a really great place and hopefully there will be an agreement. But it's not just sentiment. It's about agreement. It's about hammering out details. It's about people having escape ladders so that they can climb down from maybe lofty positions that they might need to do. But I do think that with Boris Johnson gone, with Liz Truss gone, I think in Rishi Sunak, you've got a leader who wants to solve problems rather than escalate rhetoric. And I think that now the question is what happens if he finds a way through, but either his own right wing of his party, say, we're not putting up with that, or the DUP say, we're not putting up with that. And that is when the rubber hits the road. But in terms of atmospherics, in terms of sentiment, in terms of mood, I would say we're in a very different place than we were a few months ago. But, you know, there was a John Major phrase that it was so kind of out of the 1950s when he was prime minister, where he said, well, that doesn't butter any parsnips. And I think that I don't think that, you know, sentiment gets the deal done. It helps.
No.
It's the first important step.
Absolutely.
There's still a long way to go. But, you know, I think the mood music is far better. For a while.
That's exactly it. I think the temperament around it, the mood music, the engagement has certainly been a lot better. Still a lot of hurdles, but, you know, it's completely different to what it was like with Boris Johnson and Liz Truss. So let's hope that they can move things along. So just going back to that celeb part of the Davos meeting, go on, make us a little bit sick. Tell us who else is there, who else you've been rubbing shoulders with this week.
Well, no, honestly, you know, I am just a humble footman here trying to do my job. No, there were in this room last night, there was also a princess. There was, you know, it's just that sort of thing. And that there,
it's just, you know, how you roll, John. It's just how you roll.
I thought, God, those two blokes walking down the street,
Now, they look familiar. Who the hell are they? What's government? And I realised it was Peter Schmeichel and Nemanja Matic from the ex-Man United players. Just,
very good.
Of course. Well, they're in Davos. Of course. Where else would they be?
I almost made it there once myself. I was working for the Irish government and we got as far as Zurich and then the weather became extremely bad.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and they warned us about the helicopter ride. So I'm afraid I bailed at that point. I just didn't make the final. It's difficult to get to, though, isn't it?
Oh, it's a pain in the backside to get to. I was about to use another word. If you land at Zurich Airport, you get a train from Zurich Airport into Zurich. You change trains. You get another train from Zurich to a place called Landquart, and then you change there, and you then catch the train up to Davos Platz. The train from Landquart up to Davos is one of the most beautiful train rides you will ever go on, because you're just winding up the mountain and you've got these snow-covered peaks, and it, you know, on a fine day it looks beautiful. But how is it possible that this anonymous little ski town, not known for anything much, you know, from 51 weeks a year is just kind of gets along with life quietly, and for this 1 week it becomes a completely different animal.
And do you think that's why they chose that location, or is there any rationale around why?
There's no rationale at all.
Yeah.
There's this guy who founded Davos called Klaus Schwab, who had this dream of setting it up in the mountains of Davos. It grew and grew and grew. There is a huge congress center. I mean, you have to book a hotel room for 4 nights, and I think I'm in one of the cheapest hotel rooms that you can find, and it's about £2,500 for, you know, €2,800 or whatever it is for 4 nights.
Well, but worst room in the hotel or not, John, nobody feels one bit sorry for you, I've got to tell you. But thanks very much for joining us, and we let you get back to your busy schedule.
So I haven't got the sympathy vote, is what you're trying to say.
Not at all. But thank you very much, John. Pleasure to talk to you. That was John Sopel of the New Agents podcast. This is News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. And next up, we'll be talking to the Financial Times journalist Jude Webber about the growing trend of Chinese citizens who are investing in Ireland. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, Ireland's decade-old immigrant investor programme soared in popularity in 2022, with the number of would-be investors, particularly from China, coming back to twice the annual record, which was set in 2019. To tell us what's spurring such a large number of wealthy Chinese people to invest here, I'm joined now by Jude Webber of the Financial Times, and she's their Irish correspondent. Jude, you're very welcome to Taking Stock for the first time.
Thanks very much, Mandy.
Now, before we get into what's happening on the Chinese investor side, can you just take us through what the options are for investment through the Irish Immigrant Investor Programme?
Yeah, it's a programme. It doesn't give you citizenship. Mm. It doesn't give you a passport. It's not a golden visa. It doesn't give you anything more than residency. And there's kind of strings attached. You can invest $1 million into an Irish enterprise, or you can invest $1 million into an investment fund, or you can invest $2 million into a stock exchange listed real estate investment trust, or you can just donate $500,000, or that's actually $400,000 if there are five investors who join forces and invest together. So basically, it's either an investment or it's a donation. The donation's smaller, obviously it's $400,000 or $500,000, and that gets you residency for 3 years, and then that can be extended.
Okay, but as you say, it doesn't provide passports, it's not offering citizenship. So what's actually driving the increase in interest from the Chinese industry in particular?
Well, the Chinese in particular, what people have said to me, and it's people who have availed of the scheme or people who are sort of working to bring investors into the scheme, they say that, you know, it's really a question of, there's several things, but fundamentally, you know, the reason they're looking outside China is they're looking for security. Mm. And what attracts them to Ireland is it's an English-speaking country, it's very welcoming, education is very strong here. And so, you know, a lot of people come here because they want they want to use the schools. And so really it's a hedge against the uncertainty that they feel might be you know, might be happening in China, you know, and they're looking at other places. Obviously, it's not all Chinese. It's almost all Chinese predominantly, but there are a few other nations. And the, one of the things that surprised me was that there were also investors from the US. And again, that's to do with the sort of political polarization since Trump. And people are just looking for a sort of a safe haven, a safe bet, if you like.
Mm, because political uncertainty often drives a lot of inward investment, doesn't it? So you mentioned there we're seeing interest from other places. Where else maybe increasing looking at that investor program?
Well, it's, I mean, it's predominantly really, it's sort of more than 9 out of 10 is Chinese. But there's also a few from a sort of a handful from Vietnam, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, the US, and China also includes Hong Kong as well.
Mm-hmm. And like, has the nature of the programme here in Ireland changed over the years from its original iteration?
I think it's just grown. Mm. I mean, it's slightly different to the kinds of programs that are on offer in other countries, which might be where you have to invest in property. Here, it's actually investing in a sort of an investment fund or a thing, you know, an enterprise. Some of the funds that that people invest in nursing homes or social housing, things like that. So a distinction, you know, the people who organise these funds and try and seek investors say that it reaches the type of investment, you know, it reaches parts of the economy that wouldn't otherwise be reached, and that other countries that have similar, because a lot of countries have sort of similar kinds of programs, they wouldn't necessarily get investors into those parts because they require you to buy property and only property.
Mm. Yeah, and obviously, you know, investing in areas that are particularly important in our economy at the moment, like housing, which is causing so many domestic problems in their own right. If you're just tuning in, this is News Talks Taking Stock, and I'm chatting to Jude Webber of the Financial Times. She's our Irish correspondent, and we're talking about Ireland's Immigrant Investor Programme. Jude, you mentioned there, you know, that the programme has grown over the years, but have there been things that have, you know, reset it for particular countries, like the pandemic? Has that sort of made Chinese investors look externally much, much more than they would have in the past? So has the pandemic affected it in any way?
Well, I think it has, because obviously China was locked down until very, very recently. And so that was another thing that, you know, that people who, you know, were feeling, you know, that wasn't something they wanted. It gave them the option to move abroad. And I spoke to one person who ran his business from here remotely, you know, because he couldn't get into China because, you know, he would have had to stay, I suppose, and because of the very strict COVID requirements. But actually, it's worth mentioning as well that even though this is an investor program and a residency program, people don't actually have to move here and live here all the time. They can just live one day a year. So it sort of gives that flexibility. But like you were saying, I mean, I think COVID was a driver in particular for the Chinese because they just had such very, very strict COVID restrictions.
Mm. Are there particular areas as well as sectors, like geographically, where Chinese investors are gravitating towards particularly?
No, I mean, I think a lot is in Dublin, mm-hmm. You know, big cities. But you know, I've seen projects in I don't know, Mayo, for example, in Donegal. I think it's, you know, there are opportunities in different parts of the country. But, you know, obviously Dublin, if people are going to actually take up the residency, probably Dublin is going to attract quite a lot of people.
Mm. And what about the sectors there? You mentioned nursing homes and housing. Are there other areas where you see particular investment coming from China?
Yeah, I mean, hospitality as well, you know, hotels, things like that, you know, it's those sorts of long term construction, long term, you know, funding options that I suppose give them the security to invest and that make it an interesting investment for Ireland and one that, you know, they can these funds can go out and find investors for. But I mean, you know, certainly hospitality, housing, nursing homes, that kind of thing, social, sort of the social sector, in a sense, that's very big.
Mm. I recall being on a trade mission to China many years ago and kind of looking at the scale of what their business operations were and thinking, like, is there any point to this? Like, how are we going to get them attracted in Ireland? And somebody on the trade mission, I think from the IDA, made the point to me, like, we just need to get a small amount of that to make a significant difference, because there's a lot of deep pockets over in China, isn't there?
Well, there's a lot of deep pockets. There are, you're right. But I mean, I was talking just then about the investments that they might want to make. Mm. But obviously what we've seen is the other sort of avenue, which is the donations. And if people want to invest, Chinese people want to invest sort of 400,000 or 500,000, which, you know, to perhaps some people might not seem a lot to some Chinese people, maybe that's who are interested in, you know, having a Western education for their children, for example, or who are concerned about political instability. Perhaps that's not a lot. And they can make these donations, and those ones can go into sporting and cultural projects. Mm. And that's where we've seen GAA stadiums and community centres and things like that. Mm. So those are donations. And as you say, there are lots of people in China with a lot of money, and perhaps they think that this is a very reasonable price to pay.
And finally, Jude, if I can ask you just about the relationship between Irish and Chinese people, do they work well together?
Well, the Chinese people that I've met who have taken up this program, they're just delighted by Ireland. You know, I met one of them in the pub, and he was just thrilled to bits. He was ordering his Guinness and drinking it like an Irish person. And I spoke to another person whose son goes to Trinity, in fact. And you know, they do seem to be very, you know, very happy here. I think it's very different. And that's, you know, part of the attraction. But the thing that they kept on saying over and over to me was that they were very pleased with the welcome, and they felt very at home here. Yeah. So they do seem to like it.
Well, very often we take our freedoms and things like our universities and that for granted. But look, this is a very interesting insight into that world. But for now, we'll have to leave it there. That was Jude Webber of the Financial Times. Jude, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. There was drama at Disney this week. The return of an old face hoping to revive the flagging media giant. Find out what's going on at the company after the break. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, take a quick listen to this.
Hi-ho, 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 if home to work we go.
That was, of course, Whistle While You Work from Disney's iconic Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Well, there's not a lot of whistling going on around the Disney boardroom tables at the moment, but for many, many years, Disney was a familiar sound and sight to so many of us as just wholesome, good family fun. It certainly, for me, evokes lots of childhood memories going along to the cinema to see those iconic movies. But of late, all is not well. Disney's top brass became really dissatisfied with their current CEO, who after a tricky couple of years was unceremoniously fired, only to be replaced by his predecessor, Bob Iger. So what exactly is going on, and what will this upheaval mean in terms of its ambition for new viewers and eyes on screen? We're joined now by Christopher Grimes, who is in Los Angeles, and he's the bureau chief there for the Financial Times. Christopher, thanks very much for joining us on Taking Stock today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, Bob Iger, I've mentioned him there. He's now the new CEO, and I use that in inverted commas, but it's not his first spin on this particular merry-go-round. Can you just tell us to kick off today, who exactly is Bob Iger?
So Bob Iger was a Disney lifer who became CEO to replace Michael Eisner back in about 2007. And Iger became, in his tenure, one of the most celebrated CEOs in corporate America. He transformed Disney by making some really bold acquisitions like Pixar. He bought Marvel, which turned into this huge franchise of movies. And he also bought Lucasfilm, which owns the Star Wars franchise. So all of a sudden, Disney had some of the biggest names in entertainment. And, it really did change Disney forever and made it, you know, the top entertainment company in Hollywood. He also bought a company called 21st Century Fox, which is home to Avatar and The Simpsons. And this has become a topic of late, which I'm sure we'll get into here.
Absolutely, yeah. He certainly transformed it, making it into that multinational juggernaut. And one of the other things that he did was he kind of identified a successor and a protege. Who was this and what happened to him?
Well, the succession story with Iger is really interesting because he was very good at the job. He loved the job and he didn't want to leave the job. So Bob Iger extended his contract a few times before he finally left. And even when he left and handed the reins over to Bob Chapek in 2000, he kind of remained on as chair and had this position where he oversaw creative efforts alongside Bob Chapek, who was CEO. And it was a tumultuous thing. The pandemic happened just as Bob Chapek took over as CEO. Bob Iger was still in the company, and tensions between the two guys surfaced really quickly. Then Bob Chapek, you know, he had to get the company through the pandemic. When the theme parks were shut down and people couldn't go to the movies, he had to put workers on furlough. It was really difficult. The one bright spot in his tenure was that the Disney Plus streaming service rocketed as people stayed home and binged watched. Right. So that was the good thing that happened for him. But otherwise, it was a really rough time. And lots of things happened with him, but he finally was dismissed abruptly by the board in November, and they brought Iger back. So he's been back now for about 8 weeks.
I'm always very suspicious of people who are so invested in their successor and remain on, because I don't think it ever ends well. But this is such, I suppose... it's such a big company. It's got so many interests now, far and wide. It's changing as well. What exactly was it, though, that Chapek did that alienated so many in Hollywood?
So Chapek obviously was keen to put his own stamp on the company after, you know, succeeding this larger-than-life figure. And he believed that radical change was needed inside the company to help it compete and work in the streaming age. And these changes really alienated a lot of the talent. He famously got into a war with Scarlett Johansson and her agent here in Hollywood over how she would get paid for Black Widow. And long story short on that, people like Scarlett Johansson, really big actors and actresses, would start to get a bonus on in their pay for a good performance at the box office. But because they were sort of emphasizing streaming, they said that we didn't have to pay that bonus, and that led to a big standoff. So this led a bad taste. It left a bad taste in the mouth of people in the talent community in Hollywood. So that was a big controversy. And then last year came the clash with the Florida governor over what was dubbed by its critics as the Don't Say Gay law.
Yeah, this was the Ron DeSantis row. It was a kind of culture war about what teachers can say about LGBT plus issues. What was that all about, and how did they get involved in that?
Yeah, so Disney obviously has a huge business in Florida. They're the largest private employer in Florida with all of the theme parks near Orlando, Florida. And they also employ a lot of people in the LGBTQ plus community in Florida who work at the theme parks and so forth. So when that law, or when that was just a bill in the Florida legislature, a lot of Disney employees said, you know, we have to come out and oppose this. Bob Chapek was reluctant to make a political statement on that. and he was quiet. And this upset a lot of the employees who threatened to walk out over it. And this forced Chapek's hand to finally make a statement. And when he did, he made Ron DeSantis, the governor of the state, who right now appears to be the front runner for the Republican nomination of for president in 2024. It made Ron DeSantis really angry, and he retaliated hard against the company, including by moving to strip Disney of the special tax privileges that it has in Florida and has enjoyed since Walt Disney and Roy Disney first went to Florida in the 1960s. Yeah. And that's ongoing.
Well, yeah, maybe they're displaying, you know, his lack of street smarts and dealing with the political terrain in a way that maybe Bob Iger is much better at doing. One other area where Disney has failed spectacularly of recent years is their share price, of course. I think that's down about 40%. How does something like that, obviously has a huge bearing on a massive company like that. What did the board do about that changing dynamic of the share price?
Right. So I think, interestingly, there was during the pandemic when they were adding lots of streaming subscribers, the stock was doing pretty well. But, you know, considering their theme parks were shut down and the theaters were shut, but Wall Street was really supportive of the streaming endeavor. But about this time last year, Netflix, which had been the pace setter for all of this, shocked the markets and said that instead of adding millions of subscribers, they were actually losing subscribers. And it sent a signal that to investors that this streaming business couldn't just increase forever. And so that really changed the tone in the media industry. And so the shares of all the companies have gone down. I think Disney's stock last year also took a hit because of questions about the leadership. I think the "Don't Say Gay" thing didn't reflect well on Bob Chapek or the board. The board of directors supported Chapek after the "Don't Say Gay" controversy. Then they decided to renew his contract. And then a few months later, they fired him. So it was just a bad look for, and it didn't say great things about the leadership there. The stock is up this year, I've noticed. So that's I think a reflection of people have confidence in Iger.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, and I'm talking to Los Angeles Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, Christopher Grimes. Just turning to the future, you said there that the board, the industry, I'm taking it, have confidence in Bob to repeat the success of his past, Bob Iger's I'm talking of. What do you see their future being under him? How do you think he's going to go forward and change things for the better?
Well, the board has given Bob Iger 2 years. He's in his early 70s now, and they said, you've got 2 years to come back and right the ship. Now, he's only been back in the job for 8 weeks, and we don't expect to hear a big strategy from him until February after they report their earnings. But what we do know is he said that he's going to focus on cutting costs. The streaming business is really expensive. I think the thing that set off Bob Chapek being fired was they announced they had lost $1.5 billion in their streaming business in a single quarter.
Wow!
And that shocked investors. It was a lot higher than people had expected, and now everyone is looking for a way to profitability for streaming. So I think Iger has to come up with a plan to get to profitability within the next year or so on streaming. So that's a huge deal. Mm. He's also reorganizing the or undoing the organization that Bob Chapek put in place that that had left the talent really unhappy inside the company. So he's reorganizing things to give creative people more control than they had before. He's also just got to, I think his mere presence has helped boost morale a little, but he's got a lot going on. And, the big thing in the news in the last week is he's got to fend off a challenge from a legendary activist shareholder named Nelson Peltz.
Yeah, he's not so happy about his return, is he?
Well, Peltz is walking a fine line here. So Peltz bought $900 million worth of stock in Disney, and he's demanding a seat on the board. And Iger and the Disney board don't want to let Peltz on the board. And now Peltz is taking his appeal directly to shareholders and saying Disney has lost its way. And Disney needs me to help them find the way back. Peltz has a history of taking on big companies like Procter & Gamble. And in that fight, he spent $100 million and Procter & Gamble had to spend about the same fending off that fight. So this is going to be unfolding between now and March when Disney has its big shareholder meeting. But for Iger, just as he's trying to get his head around how to reshape the company for the, you know, kind of post-streaming euphoria age, he's got this distraction to deal with as well. And this could be really nasty. It's already kind of nasty.
The last thing he needs really when he's trying to kind of introduce stability and bring back that sense of leadership that seems to be just so sadly lacking. Christopher, is the company extremely bloated as well? Some of the figures that I looked at in relation to Chapek's exit package and the salary, like they were eye-watering. Just to give our listeners here in Ireland an idea of the figures we're talking about, 20 million he got for his exit and goodbye. That's not a bad way to leave a company, is it?
Right, yeah. That's right. I mean, Chapek had been at the company for 30 years and he did some things pretty well. He was good on getting the theme parks business back and running after the pandemic, after the worst of the pandemic. But it's still a big chunk of change. The communications director that he brought in, and who only lasted for a few months, also got a multi-million dollar severance package. So, yeah, it's a company it's a big company and they spend a lot.
Yeah, big ship to turn around. Just finally, Christopher, if I can, what do you see happening to them in the medium to longer term under his direction? Do you think he'll get things back on track, and how will they stack up against Netflix and the other streaming companies in the end, in your view?
Well, the whole streaming industry is now having this kind of crisis moment. Netflix is the only one that makes money. Disney is Disney, and its rivals in streaming are all losing lots of money. And this is not.
Can I interrupt you there? Why are Netflix making money and the others aren't? What's the differentiation there?
Well, Netflix had a good head start, they've. They've got over 200 million paying customers, and they don't have a lot of the baggage that the other legacy companies have. And profitability is still pretty new for Netflix. This just this happened in the last year or so, to try to reach profitability, Netflix and Disney and the others are turning to things like advertisement advertisements on some tiers of their services. And Netflix is starting to crack down on people who share their passwords, which is a lot of people. Yeah. And this is going to be an effort this year for them. So this is a tough thing. And, you know, the core business for a lot of these legacy media companies like Disney and Paramount in the United States has been television. It has been cable television, where people had to pay a very high monthly bill just to watch television. And this is that business is dying quickly, and it's a big problem because TV has been subsidizing the streaming investments, and now that is shrinking really fast. This is hanging over their heads.
Do you ever think, from a brand perspective, though, Disney are just straying too far away from what their core offering was? I found myself watching The Patient the other night on Disney. There's just something about the juxtaposition of Disney offering those type of things that doesn't really sit quite correctly for me.
You know, that's interesting. A few Wall Street analysts have been talking about this, and also in a roundabout way, Nelson Peltz has also been talking about that. I think, you know, Bob Iger's last big acquisition was 21st Century Fox. And this brought a lot of general entertainment into Disney that it never really had before. Mm. You know, it had been Star Wars, it had been Disney Animation and Pixar Animation and that kind of family fare. And all of a sudden they had, with Fox, they had a more general offering. And so I think the theory there was that they could better compete with Netflix by having a broader offering of shows. They could have dramas. They could have, you know, they could have racier fare. And some people think, you know, that's not really Disney.
Maybe it's just a question of Coca-Cola trying to sell orange juice, and it just doesn't sit right. But I think that maybe if they put their boardroom shenanigans on the big screen, they might solve some of their streaming problems. We could talk about this all day, absolutely. But for now, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. That's Christopher Grimes in Los Angeles, Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Christopher, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. And while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Next week, we'll be looking at the challenges that are faced by suppliers to source medication. If you want to get in contact with us, you can email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. My thanks to today's guests and to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy, with Hugo Da Silva on sound. Future Proof is up next, and then it's Gavin Riley with On the Record. But for now, for me, Mandy Johnston, that was Taking Stock. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.